tonight we'll move on to our third beatitude. Blessed are the meek. As we've said earlier, what Jesus talks about here is really kind of the reverse of what the world thinks. The world thinks about power and might, and Jesus talks about being the meek, the humble. Actually, if you go to Psalm 37, which I'm about to do, after I pick up these things that fell out of my Bible, that's the problem. A lot of times I look around and say, I know that I have that somewhere, and it's stuck in one of the 10 or 15 Bibles I've got around. Psalm 37, verse 11. But the meek shall inherit the land and delight themselves in abundant prosperity. Now, verse 10 is kind of the setup for that. Yet while a little while, and the wicked will be no more, though you look diligently for their place, they will not be there, but the meek shall inherit the land. The Hebrew word there is land, as in the promised land, the land that is around them. When in this parable, in the Greek, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth, the Greek word ge can mean soil, land, earth, any of those, country, the root word for country. So the meek shall inherit the land and delight themselves in abundant prosperity. Psalm 37, 11 reads primarily as a promise to tenant farmers, a promise to small people that own small plots of land who were oftentimes oppressed by the rich and the wicked and always trying to snatch it up, people trying to do excessive taxes so that if they couldn't pay the taxes, then they could take the property. I know that never happens in the modern and postmodern world, but that's what that was about, and it was a promise that at some point the oppression by the rich would end and they would be able to have their fair share and not have to worry. If they're faithful to God, God would watch out for them. So that understanding was slightly different, well, not slightly, a pretty good bit different from the typical modern understanding of a meek person. The meek here were those who were powerless but who were promised something. Modern ideas of a meek person include what, other than the fact, I say, spineless, subservient, somebody like Don Knotts in The Ghost of Mr. Chicken, if you ever saw that old movie. People used to talk about Johnny Milk Toast. What are some of the other things you think about when you think about a meek person? Okay, somebody that won't stand up, not even for themselves. Won't stand up for anybody else either. Okay? That's the way typically we look at it, and that's the way that the Romans would look at it, the Greeks. For example, the Jews asserted their pride of being Jews, their race, not just their religion, but their ethnicity, although it was pretty blended and pretty mixed after a while, but they asserted their pride of race. The Romans asserted power, and they were proud of their power and their ability to walk over anybody anytime they wanted to. Greeks, their pride was gnosis, knowledge. The more knowledge, the more philosophy you understood, the more prideful a person was. The meek here is a contrast. In Jesus' understanding, the meek are those, and this is further down here, but I'll go ahead and mention it. The meek are those who are content to walk in a calm, quiet godliness. They know that they have God behind them. They know that they're in good relationship with God. They know that they could pray for power from God to do something to somebody else, but instead of doing so, they're content, not taking advantage of other people, but rather they're content walking with God, being humble-minded. Humble-minded is another way The meek are humble-minded and rather gentle in the way they deal with others. And they are that way because they have humbled themselves before God. And the way they do that is to basically say, okay, here's God, here I am, how do I measure up? Well, I don't. There's nothing within me, in and of myself, that makes me good enough. And so when they come to realize that and recognize that that God is their source, even the one in Psalm 37, the recognition was there that the only way the wicked and the rich would stop oppressing was the promise of God that someday God would intervene on their behalf. And that was the hope on which they held. The Greek word here for meek is praeus, sometimes praus. It comes from proteis. And it has ethical dimensions about it. As I mentioned here, Aristotle contends meekness is a happy medium between the extremes of being extremely excessively angry, I guess what my grandmother would have called mad, foaming at the mouth. You can be extremely angry, but extremely excessively angry, I guess you might foam at the mouth. Right? It's kind of the happy medium between that kind of anger and a lack of any anger whatsoever. Nobody can push your buttons. Nobody can get you riled up whatsoever. And either extreme was seen as wrong. Of course, Aristotle and the Stoics and others would look at that. You know, Mr. Spock, some of y'all in here are old enough to remember Mr. Spock in the original Star Trek. Now, Mr. Spock, the Vulcan, would be the perfect Stoic. He would go along with Aristotle here. No extremes either way. Not extremely happy, not extremely sad or mad. Things on an even keel all the way through. Not showing emotion, etc. And so that was one of the norms that Aristotle pled that people would do. And this was the happy medium between the two. You had to find that center point, what a lot of folks would call a centering point. In fact, I don't know if you're aware or not, but in the last few years, especially in monastic communities, but it's also moved outside when people start talking a lot about spirituality and they have spirituality workshops and stuff. They talk about introspective prayer, that is centering prayer, getting the center back on course instead of leaning either way or the other. And the calm that centering prayer or introspective prayer would bring. And that doesn't mean that you sit around and you go om and you look at your navel. But it's spending quiet time. In fact, I was reading something the other day and I thought, I tried this one time and after about 2 minutes went ahead with the prayer. But I had thought about one time either a prayer meeting, and we may do it off in the future. You know, we got 30 minutes. Well, by the time the announcements and the jokes and the song ends, we got about 16 minutes. It's just saying, okay, well, let's hear the prayer request and all. Let's bow for a word of prayer. And then just not say anything. And let people contemplate and pray in silence for 16 minutes. When's the last time, and I'm not asking for show of hands, when's the last time you spent more than a minute or two silently in prayer? Not too many people do that. I did that with a class one time, sitting, we were talking about prayer. I said, I know some of you may not be prayers, but we're going to spend about 5 minutes in absolute silence in prayer. We got about a minute and a half in before somebody started shifting in their seat. You could hear the desk creak. Somebody else started clearing their throat. And before 5 minutes was up, I could hear people whispering. And they weren't talking to God. They were whispering to each other. That's one of those times I closed my eyes. Now, I will tell you, I never close my eyes when somebody says at a religious meeting, they say, okay, I want everybody at the end of a sermon to say, I want everybody in here to bow your head and close your eyes, nobody looking around. I don't. I look around. You wouldn't believe the number of times when they say, I see that hand, and I'm thinking, really? You must have x-ray vision. I don't see a hand anywhere. No, because usually at those meetings, I'm sitting on the back row. If I know it's going to be one of those. But, you know, that this whole thing of centering oneself. And that's really, if you think about Aristotle and the Stoics and that whole idea there, the point really of meekness or any of these and the point of prayer is to try and center ourselves so that we're not off kilter one way or the other. But I wonder if we'd make it 16 minutes on a Wednesday night. Oh, well, we might try it someday. Or some night. But between those extremes, it's kind of a sense that, well, as Barclay, William Barclay, in his commentary writes, it means one who is always angry at the right time and never angry at the wrong time. And what he describes as the right and wrong time is to be angry when injury, improper injury, is done to somebody else. But you don't let it get out of check. Or out of hand, you keep it in check. And never angry at the wrong time, that's when you're insulted. Interesting concept. We should always try and be even keeled, and if we're going to be angry, we should be angry when other people are wrongly treated. But if we're wrongly treated, we shouldn't get angry. We should try to find other ways through the emotion. Selfish anger is always a sin. Why? Because what's at the heart of selfish anger? Self. Yeah. Ego. Me. I. You know, in the center letter in the word sin is I. And oftentimes it's a capital I. So, selfish anger is always a sin. Selfless anger can be one of the greatest moral dynamics of the world. But that doesn't mean that we run out and smash somebody's head in. Selfless anger, that is, anger because someone else is being treated unjustly and unfairly, can be a great moral changer. A moral dynamic where we do speak up for the rights of others. We do speak up and take up for that person that's being mistreated. But a lot of times we want to kind of step back in the shadows, right? Especially these days. Other understandings of meek include it's the opposite of aggressive. It's not harsh. It's not self-assertive. It's not brute force. It is rather one who is humble, should be in strength and reverence, one who is concerned about the proper thing to do, who walks in quiet godliness, that is, content to walk or live out of the spotlight where God watches over faithful children. It's also this understanding of meekness derives, at least in part, from farmers and animals. It's the meekness that the animal finally comes to the point, the animal that has learned to answer the reins, no longer has to be hit with the whip or hobbled or smacked between the eyes with a 2x4. But it's the animal who's learned the movement of the reins in gentle guiding. You don't want to regularly have to ride a horse and yank on the reins, do you? In fact, there are people, my youngest brother, who's now got 5 horses. That's just the 2 of them. So. But one of his horses, well, he hadn't ridden it in a while, because he said, "Keeper's on a diet." I said, "Really?" He said, "Yep." He's lost 150 pounds. He's only got 350 more to go. I let him get too fat. Can't even get the saddle on him. But Phil can get up, and with Keeper, they become so, you know, he trained him, and they become so much one, he doesn't even have to hold on to the reins. He can just, a little pressure with his knees, and Keeper goes where he. In fact, they're at the point, you know, it's kind of strange. Anyone tell me what the name Philip means? One of the primary meanings? He was named Philip when he was born. Lover of horses. He's in elementary school. He's a good artist. Used to draw horses and dogs. Now he's got horses and dogs and a wife. And sometimes it's in that order. Depending on the day, sometimes it's in that order. But Karen likes the horses too. Phil also has some interesting issues that when he had his major back surgery several years ago, I think some of the drugs fried certain synapses in his brain, so he has trouble sleeping a lot. And he never cusses anybody else out. He doesn't hit them, but his temper can go like that. And when he can't sleep, he'll go out sometimes in the pasture. Keeper is standing, and he will lay there and go to sleep on the horse's back and sleep 2 or 3 hours just laying on a horse. A horse never moves, just stands there. But, you know, it's that sense, the animal who's learned to answer the reins, the meek person has learned to answer, doesn't need to be smacked in the face by God, but rather the gentle movement of God, the gentle guiding of God, through which he or she readily finds freedom and finds peace. To walk in quiet godliness, to live in the spotlight, out of the spotlight where God watches over the faithful. Now, a total dependency on God. Interesting thing is, I had heard this, and so I consulted somebody who knows French, because I don't know French, other than fries and toast. But if you, in French, the word in this one is blessed are the debonair. The debonair. We think of debonair as somebody who's suave and sophisticated and all that kind of stuff. But actually, the understanding of debonair here, it's a secondary understanding as one who counts his own life as nothing and will give it for the sake of others. Blessed are the debonair, those who put others' lives and others' desires before their own. A person who is self-controlled, that is, one who recognizes that he has the power to give in to all his emotions but keeps them under control, is a part of this sense of meekness. Instead of letting anger get the best of us, we control the anger. Instead of absolutely falling apart at the drop of a hat, the least little thing, we control the emotion. Instead of getting inherently violent when something happens that we don't like, we control that sense of violence. It's someone who is self-controlled, who knows, I've got the power to give in, but by golly, I'm not going to give in. I'm going to control it, even if I have to count to 520,000 to get there. Yeah, I learned a long time ago that some things, 10, 10's not even half a breath on getting there. Yeah. Some things years ago, some things it'd take me 25 or 30 before I even started calming down. You know, you're supposed to count to 10. But it's one who controls their emotions and impulses. It indicates one who is humble-minded enough to know his own limitations or her own limitations, to know our own weaknesses and to know our own needs, and then seek those from God and other folks who are connected with God around us, friends and family, church folks. It's a kind of forbearance. Immanuel Kant, philosopher Immanuel Kant, his father was in business, had a lot of interests in saddles and bridles, the making of those, the selling of them, that kind of thing. And Kant tells a story about his father being truly one that was filled with, his word was, with forbearance, which would be another way to understand meekness here. Forbearance. And said his father's forbearance was so great that when his business interests were affected by fights and riots between bridle makers and saddlers, his father tried to stand in between and be the mediator, but said when the subject would come up at family dinners or family gatherings and other people would say, well, you just ought to do this and you just ought to do that, said that his father, he said, and I quote, even in conversations about those quarrels in family, when it was mentioned, with great forbearance and love toward the opponents, my father, even though it affected his business, even though he was probably like, in some ways like Paul at the churches of Galatia when he was caught between two warring factions in those churches, only Paul wasn't meek and mild. Paul let go of both barrels. But said that Kant said his father had so much forbearance that when other people in the family started pointing fingers and saying, well, this is what you ought to do to straighten them out, his response was always with forbearance and with love and with grace, and we need to find a way to treat them with love and with grace, forbearance, etc. He said that's the, when he thought of meekness, his father immediately came to mind because that's the way his father operated. Not only did he not really get mad, he didn't show anger. So what will happen to the meek? Well, from society's standpoint, what's going to happen to the meek? What does society think will happen to the meek? Yeah, destroy them. Back in the 60s, there was a church started in San Francisco. And the founder of that church put together, along with some of his followers, a Bible. Anton Sandor LaVey. Anybody ever heard of him before? A few people. Anton Sandor LaVey started the First Church of Satan. It was in Haight-Ashbury District in California. And they put together something called the Satanic Bible. And when it comes to the Beatitudes, basically flip them over in the opposite direction. And that's what you got. And other kinds of things. But In this, it's blessed are the strong, for they will conquer the meek and conquer the earth. And as a sidelight, there is a place in there where he talks about if someone is, you know, if you want something, take it, especially if the person is meek, and if they are meek and they complain at all, destroy them. The world thinks you destroy the meek, or you run over the meek. Whether you destroy them or not, you take advantage of them. Jesus says, no, the meek, those who are truly humble-minded and in that kind of relationship with God, will be the ones who will inherit the earth. Now, whether it literally means the earth, or whether it is a metaphor for the new heaven, the new earth, the heavenly Jerusalem, or whether it's in between, as I mentioned down here, some people, primarily Jehovah's Witnesses, take this to mean the new earth of Revelation, where all the Jehovah's Witnesses will be except for the 144,000 that were chosen by God to go there. Most people think that it's a promise of a grand place in heaven. But to inherit, what's an inheritance? An inheritance is a legacy. An inheritance is a gift. Something that you get because, why? Because you're part of the family and because of the relationship of family. Some people don't get that inheritance because they get cut out of it. Because they don't have the relationship. Something happens. And in the Old Testament era, well, even beyond, I'm sure it goes on even today. If there were a lot of sons, the oldest son, when the father died, the oldest son got a double portion. Everybody else got a single portion. And the oldest son's still alive when the father died. Got control of the family business. That's why there are many cases where you will find, especially in certain areas, you'll find there's some suspicion when the older brother dies and the next one steps up, and then a few years later that one dies and the next one steps up. You had to watch your back. That happened with the Maccabees. Not Alan Gloria. But that happened with the Maccabees. By the way, a few years ago, Al said, got a copy of that book that's in the Apocrypha called the Maccabees? I said, yeah. You want it in a small book? You want it by itself? Or you want it in the middle of a big Bible? He said, I'll just take the small book. He said, I've always heard about the Maccabees, and I'd like to read it. So, First Maccabees is pretty good historical writing. But Judas Maccabeus, who led the Maccabean revolt when the Syrians almost and Seleucids almost destroyed Judaism from the face of the earth during the reign of Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, people thought he might be Messiah. And for a couple of years, he was doing a pretty good job after he had restored proper worship in the temple and that kind of stuff and killed the Seleucids or ran them off, except for one group that he let stay in a fortress rather than lose more men, and they said, "Well, we'll live by your rules and regulations." Well, 3 years later, he was assassinated by those same people, and there is some evidence in history that one of the brother that stepped up and took his place might have had something to do with that. He was assassinated within a year, and we know that his younger brother had something to do with that, and he stepped up and took the spot. So, you know, it's kind of tough. I'm sure we don't have people knocking off people these days just to get the inheritance. But, or doing other things or creating problems. But the inheritance was a gift. It was a legacy not meant to be taken by force. An inheritance really is not meant to be taken by force. It's a gift. You know, a lot of people think you have to leave it to your kids, except for those that have the bumper sticker and they're driving a big RV pulling another vehicle behind and says, "I'm spending my kids' and my grandkids' inheritance." But you don't have to. Even by the force of one's will, you cannot take the inheritance. The inheritance is a gift. You might take the money and the property, but you're not taking the inheritance, because the inheritance technically is a gift given to heirs that are true children of the rightful owner, the rightful possessor. If God is indeed the rightful owner and rightful possessor, and we are meek from the standpoint of being humble-minded and in proper relationship with God, then the inheritance is promised. The inheritance is promised, and that is to inherit the earth, or initially, many of Jesus' hearers here probably would have thought, inherit the promised land where they were. And I guess in 1948, a lot of other folks thought that too. Although I don't think they were too meek when they created the state of Israel. And I know during the Six-Day War, they weren't. So, the inheritance is something you don't take by force. An aggressive person rants and raves his or her judgment. When they do that, his or her judgment's clouded, and often irrationally or cruelly approach situations seeking only his way or her way, one way or the other. One way or the other. Charles Rand Kennedy writes, and I quote, "Jesus was meek and inherits the earth, which our aggressions only destroy." End of quote. If we don't take the same meekness, I mean, look at Jesus, who had the power, who had the authority, who had the ability, and had every right to take what he wanted, but instead he humbled himself and became obedient and gives us the example of meekness. I was in a meeting not long ago, and the fellow was talking a little bit about this, about leadership. And he said, you know, you cannot truly lead until you master yourself and your selfishness. You cannot truly serve until you have subjected yourself to service. You cannot be in control of others until you learn to control yourself. I actually had that written down. It's in one of my other Bibles that I had with me. But I found it the other day and wrote it down here. You cannot truly lead until you master yourself and your own selfishness. You cannot truly serve until you have subjected yourself to serving. And you cannot be in control of others until you learn to control yourself. A truly meek person, from the perspective of quiet godliness and self-control, seeks to be organized in regards to God and the way we treat others. Genuine meekness, in fact, genuine meekness, I would contend, according to Jesus, becomes our one and only hope. Genuine meekness becomes our one and only hope if we're truly going to live a Christian life and inherit the earth, wherever that is, whether we're talking about heaven or whether we're talking about starting now, living in our inheritance as it's meant to be lived. You know, Jesus talked about the kingdom of God is here with you now. The kingdom of God is among you. Perhaps that's what he's talking about. I know I'm jumping ahead here, but perhaps that's what he's talking about. That true meekness will allow us to understand and inherit the kingdom of God now and to live in the kingdom of God now and off into the future. It's self-control for God's sake, which is fortitude, strength, a well-controlled power, and not weakness. Meekness is a self-control for God's sake, which is fortitude, strength, and a well-controlled power. Any of us, have you ever known somebody that was, I mean, just meek and mild, and you thought, that person, they couldn't beat their way out of a wet noodle, much less a paper bag. And they're always getting walked on and this kind of stuff. And one day they snap. If you haven't seen that, go watch A Christmas Story. That movie that they show for 24 hours around Christmas. When Ralphie finally has had enough of the bully. And he snaps. Rassa, frassa, rassa, frassa, frassa, rassa. You know. What? You've got the power, but you control the power. That's not weakness. You could snap, but you don't. You control it. That's not weakness. Actually, that takes fortitude and that takes strength. And what Jesus is saying is only the people who can truly control themselves in relationship with God and others will be the ones who will benefit from the inheritance, who will see that inheritance. And not just down the road, but even now. Those qualities now. Now, this is a whole lot easier for me to stand up here and say than it is for me to do. I've already told y'all on numerous occasions it's a good thing I don't have a paintball gun in my car. Because when I'm trying to get somewhere, and I know it's not Hazel Allen or Judy League that I'm behind, because I wouldn't have to blow my horn when I go by them and say, get off the road. If you can't drive any better than that, you don't need to be driving. I couldn't keep up with Judy. I don't think my car would go that fast. No. I've told you that. But when, and it seems like when I really need to get somewhere, that's when I get behind that person. And it's a good thing I don't have a paintball gun in my car, because I drive by and go, boom, that one's marked, y'all. Don't get behind that person. But it means, you know, and I've got the power to do that. My son actually left a paintball gun. I don't have any paintball, but it left a paintball gun in the closet at the house. But I don't. But oh, well, then when we get stopped, I'll toss over to you. He did it. He no. But those times when somebody's gotten on her last nerve, or that straw that broke the camel's back, we can't hold it up any longer. And we know we've got the power to let somebody hold it. You know, there's some folks that you'd much rather them just go ahead and take a bull whip than give you a tongue lashing. But instead of that, we find that point of center and back away and show forbearance. That's a whole lot easier to say than it is to do. But that's the direction we're supposed to go. To seek to be among the humble-minded and the meek. To inherit the earth. I already mentioned a while ago that the Greek word can be translated soil, land, earth. And for some, primarily the Jehovah's Witnesses, that means the new earth in Revelation. Most people, or many people, and then I said most question mark, see it as a promise that I'm going to inherit a mansion in heaven somewhere, or whatever that is. Y'all ever see, I've mentioned this before, y'all ever see the, thought it was an interesting episode. The episode about an old guy that coon hunted with his dog. They're coon hunting at night, and they end up falling. He ends up falling in a pond, and he can't swim, and he's trying to get out, and the dog comes in. When the commercial cuts away, old black and white version, when the commercial cuts away, they're still floundering in the water. When they come back from the commercial, he and the dog are lying out, and evidently the dog has saved his life. But as it turns out, they've died. Because he goes back to his house. They eventually make it down the road to his house, and his wife's in mourning and all this kind of stuff, and he realizes they've died. So they keep walking down the road, and they come to this big gate, and there's this guy standing there in overalls, or as a lot of folks say, he's standing there in overhauls and by the gate. And he asked him what it is. You know, so we're dead. Is this heaven? Oh, yeah, this is heaven. Said, you can come on in. You can do anything you want to. He said, well, can my dog come with me? And the dog starts growling. He says, no, we don't let dogs. He said, but we coon hunted every night. My wife would cook supper and leave it in the stove. We coon hunted every night. I'd eat it when we come, and I'd give him some of it. In fact, when I was in the process of dying, he jumped in to try and save me. I said, no, you can't. You can come in and do anything else, but you can't bring your dog. He said, well, if I can't coon hunt, then if I can't bring my dog in, I guess I'll just have to go to the other place. No, you come on in, but leave it. No. And so he goes down the road. A little bit later, he comes to another gate with another guy looks like that in overhauls. And he invites him in. He says, well, can I bring my dog? And he said, sure, you can bring your dog. He said, I can? He said, yeah. He said, can we coon hunt? He said, oh, yeah, we got plenty of place out here. You can coon hunt all you want to. And he said, well, he looked at him and said, okay. He said, come on, boy. He said, come on in. He said, I guess they wouldn't let us in heaven, but they'll let us in hell. And the guy said, oh, whoa. The other place was hell. They wouldn't let your dog in because the dog knew where it was. But this is heaven. You can come in. And as it walked off, he said, so I can coon. Yeah, you can coon hunt all the time if you want to. So I guess, you know, his idea of heaven was to be able to coon hunt all the time. You know, just kind of a little interesting take on this whole thing of I'm going to have a mansion in the sky, walk through the pearly gates and walk on the streets of gold and stars in my crown. Of course, we forget that it says that anybody that has a crown is going to have to give them up and lay it at the feet. Right? Or, boy, so-and-so, sure, boy, they're so good, they got to have a big mansion somewhere on the other side of the tracks. I don't know why we decided there were different levels and different tracks. And I guess that's for the train. Curtis Mayfield, any impressions? People get ready, there's a train a-coming. Yeah, so you don't need no luggage, you just get on board. All you need is faith, keep the diesel humming. You don't need no ticket, you just thank the Lord. So I guess that's what the tracks are for. But, you know, that's what some people think. Others, though, recognize that in Jesus' message that the kingdom of God is among you or present now, that the disciplined meek inherit the earth and the kingdom of heaven starting now. We're part of the kingdom now. We can start living kingdom lives now. But only if we are truly in a spirit of meekness in relationship to God, humble-mindedness, a strength which is not spineless but recognizes forbearance and the goodness that God gives to us and that we are to share with others. Even when we're being mistreated, to be humble-minded enough to know our own limitations and our own ignorance, to walk in quiet godliness, that sense of peace. Like I said, Jesus, these things that Jesus said, you know, we think, oh, that's so nice. Well, it was different back then than it is today. They didn't have all these things going on we got going on today. Now, who was he talking to? And who was in power? Not the people he was talking to. And who had the money? Not most of the people he was talking to that day. In fact, technically, when he started out with these, he's talking to those 12 that are around him. And they don't even have a place to put their head regularly. Jesus is offering here a look into what it is to truly be a Beatitude Christian. And it is really about, at its heart, it is about attitude. Attitude toward God, attitude toward others, and recognition of who we are. I thought this was going to be short tonight. I was going to be finished 5 minutes early, and it's 2 minutes over. I shouldn't have told you all that story about the Twilight Zone and the coon hunting. Three and a half. I'm going by that one in my watch. And Verizon says it's 6:47. So. Anything else that you all would like to add? Or? If not, I hope you have not only a good evening, but a good week, and find yourself among the meek, that is humble-minded, passionate about God, and helping others in any way you can. God bless you. Go in peace. Amen.